It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. The University of Wisconsin-Green Bay women's basketball team is returning to the NCAA tournament for the second year in a row, securing an automatic bid by winning the Horizon League Conference tournament last week.
The UW-Green Bay Phoenix finished their regular season at the top of the Horizon League, and they take their 22-game winning streak to Maryland on Saturday afternoon, where they will play the Alabama Crimson Tide for the first time in the program's 52-year history.
Joining us now are two of the team's seven seniors to reflect on their collegiate careers and look ahead to their final games playing for the Phoenix. Cassie Schiltz is a guard and graduated from Luxembourg Casco High School in Kewaunee County. Cassie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also joining us, Callie Genke is also a guard. She graduated from Freedom High School in Outagamie County. Callie, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let's start with this 22-game win streak that you have. It's the second longest in all of college basketball right now, behind only the Grand Canyon University women's team from the Western Athletic Conference. Cassie, what's behind this 22-game win streak?
I would just say that we're not really focusing on the win streak. We're just focusing on one game at a time. So we're just really focused each week on who we play next and how we can give our best effort offensively and defensively, and just really playing together.
Callie, you started the season with two straight losses with a brand new coach. What turned the season around for this team?
I think we just stuck together. The losses, you know, you always just kind of come back after, see what could have gone better. Just sticking together and kind of finding our groove.
Yeah, and Callie, what's been the highlight of the season so far for you?
I think going to the NCAA tournament again. That's always kind of our goal throughout the whole season. So now that we're here.
Sure, let's talk about that. You're going to take on Alabama on Saturday starting at 12:30. You can watch the game on ESPN2. Now, Alabama finished sixth in the SEC, and they lost in the second round of their conference tournament. Cassie, what do you think the difference is going to be in Saturday's game for this team?
Alabama's a really good team. We haven't scouted them that much yet in practice, but just doing my own research a little, they're a really good team. So we're going to have to play really strong defense. They're a little taller than us, which they usually are in the SEC, but we're just going to have to play strong defense and then still be able to score on the offensive end.
Callie, take us back to the NCAA tournament last season where you took on another SEC team, the Tennessee Volunteers. What did you learn from that you plan to take into Saturday's match?
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into, you know, going to the NCAA tournament, a lot of new things. So I think with going last year, experiencing those things, playing bigger teams, and we kind of set up a good non-conference to also play big teams so that we can be prepared for this in the postseason.
So the UW-Green Bay women's team made the Sweet 16 back in 2011. I can't help but notice that team was led by the then Horizon League Player of the Year, Kayla Karius, who happens to be your first-year coach right now. What has the coach told you about her experience in the tournament and the plans that you have to make it past the first round and maybe back to the Sweet 16? Cassie, I'll ask you.
She mentioned this yesterday, just going in, being confident. When they played in the Sweet 16, they played Baylor, obviously against Brittany Griner.
Yeah.
So coach actually had to guard her, but they just went in being confident and knowing what their team was capable of and just not being afraid of the moment. It's a bigger team, but, I mean, our team is super talented as well. So just playing together and being confident and going in knowing that we're able to get a win.
Callie, I want to ask you about the first year for Coach Akarius and the legacy that was left by one of the winningest coaches in women's basketball history, which is really saying something, Kevin Borseth. What was the changeover like for this team and a change of leadership?
Yeah, we were all kind of surprised when Coach Borseth retired, but the transition went really smoothly. We were all really excited when Coach Akarius took the job. And it was really nice. We kind of met in the middle of a lot of things, had a lot of conversations about offense and defense and what we're both comfortable with. So it went really smoothly, and it was awesome to get an alumni. And obviously she was super successful here. So bringing her back to Green Bay was really well done.
Yeah, and Cassie, what's the leadership been like under Coach Karius in the first year, and how does it compare to Coach Borsis?
They're obviously different people, but Coach Kayla has let Kevin even like come to a couple practices and help her out a little bit. So I think the transition went really smooth, and she's a great coach, a great leader. She experienced Green Bay basketball herself, so I think that has really helped her because she knows what it's like to be in our footsteps. But yeah, she's overall a great coach and a great leader and a great mom as well. So really excited and happy that I got to spend my last year with her as our coach.
Cassie Schultz is a guard with the UW Green Bay Phoenix, who will take on Alabama in the NCAA tournament on Saturday. Also joining us, Callie Genke, another guard with the team. Both of them are seniors, and you have seven seniors on this team. Callie, what does the experience of this team bring to the tournament this weekend?
Yeah, like you said, seven seniors, lots of experience. People have been here, which I think will help us a lot. You could kind of see throughout the year in some of our close games, we've really stayed composed and collected, and I think that just comes with experience. So I think that will help a lot. Obviously, this is a good team we're playing, so being able to stay calm and collected in those moments will be really important.
While you have a 12th seed in your bracket for the NCAA tournament, your defense ranks 18th in Division I women's basketball, and you have the Horizon League Defensive Player of the Year, another senior, in Jasmine Kondrakiewicz. Callie, does defense win championships?
Oh, I definitely think so. We always say that, defense kind of leads to offense, so you got to be able to get some stops in order for your offense to feel good. So we take a lot of pride in it and really coach each other on like things that can help us out during the game.
Cassie, tell us a little bit about what makes one of the best defenses in the nation.
I would say that defense has, over my 6 years, defense has always been like the most important principle. So we spend a lot of our practice time on our defense, but we just really coach each other, and having the Defensive Player of the Year, Bailey Butler, on our team definitely helps, as well as Jazz was all defensive team. But Cal, Maddie, Nat, Maya, everybody is just, they're so good at defense and they want to get stops. So I just think we're all super competitive and we play really hard together. And we know that our defense will create our offense.
Cassie, when's the team go to Maryland?
We're thinking Thursday. We don't know for sure yet.
Don't know for sure yet. Now, it'll be neutral territory for the first round of the tournament when you take on Alabama and Maryland. But if Maryland wins their first round game as a fourth seed, it appears as though when you beat Alabama on Saturday, you might take on Maryland on their home turf in the second round on Monday. What's it like to go to enemy territory, Cassie?
I've never been to Maryland before, so we played them a year or two ago in a Thanksgiving tournament, and I think we ended up losing around by 5, 6 points. So I mean, we have played them before, but it'll be different if we do end up playing them on their home court. But same thing, just one game at a time.
Yeah. Callie, I'm curious about growing up with basketball and what it took to become a Division I college athlete. What's that been like for you?
Yeah, I started playing basketball at a pretty young age. Played AAU since 5th grade. It's just something I've always loved to do. So just the
What's
time and
AU?
dedication. It's like club basketball,
Okay.
travel, summer basketball.
And Cassie, what was your experience like, and what led you to Division I basketball?
I started playing basketball when I was really young. I actually have a little basketball court in my parents' basement. So me and my sister just grew up down there, always practicing. I just kind of wanted to be like her. She was older. So yeah, I also played summer basketball. And that's how me and Cal actually both ended up getting recruited. We played for the same team, but different ages. So yeah, AU basketball really helped get recruited, and then played throughout high school, and then ended up at Green Bay.
What advice would you give to young girl basketball players who are looking to continue playing basketball into college?
I would just say Chase your dreams and work really hard. You have to sacrifice other things like going to hang out with your friends when you're younger. You got to put in more shots. You have to do the little things. So you just really have to work hard, and you can achieve your goals.
Kelly Genke, what are the lessons you're taking from basketball, you plan to take from basketball after graduating from UW Green Bay?
I think there's a lot of things that basketball teaches you. One that we kind of talk about a lot is accountability. We have high standards for our team, and so we're all going to hold ourselves accountable and then hold each other accountable as well. So that's a big one. There's a lot of leadership skills, a lot of time management that goes into playing at this level. So a lot of good skills that I can take into my life and the workforce.
And it sounds like those time management skills are something you needed to learn early on, just before even entering Division I basketball. Cassie, what do you plan to do after you graduate from UW Green Bay? What are your future plans?
That's a great question. I plan to graduate with my master's in business management and sports management in May. And then I am not sure what my future holds. I might get into coaching, or I might just find a business job.
And quickly, Callie, what are you got plans?
I actually just started my master's this spring. So next year I will be finishing that while being a GA in the athletic department.
Thank you both for joining us today, and best of luck to you in the tournament this weekend.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Callie Genke and Cassie Schiltz are seniors on the UW Green Bay Phoenix women's basketball team. They return to the NCAA tournament basketball tournament as a number 12 seed, taking on the 5th seed Alabama Crimson Tide on Saturday. This is UW Green Bay's 20th trip to the Big Dance in the program's 52-year history. Tip off at 12:30, and you can watch it all on ESPN2.
Coming up, dig into a listener's question about height restrictions on Madison buildings and preserving views of the state capitol.
Buildings that are within a mile of the center of the Capitol building cannot exceed the height of the base of those columns. So essentially making sure that dome really remains that prominent feature within our downtown landscape.
That's ahead on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Lee Rayburn. As solar energy projects have expanded across Wisconsin, some in local communities have tried to stop large-scale solar farms from being built in rural areas. As Joel Scholes reports, a new bill would require local governments to approve solar or wind projects before state regulators.
Bob Frazee walks through the rows and rows of solar panels at the Paris Solar Park in Kenosha County. He works for We Energies and gave a tour of the site last month. He says the park's 500,000 solar panels are programmed to track the sun.
And then as the day goes on, those panels will just keep moving, keep moving. You come out here midday when the sun's kind of directly above us, those panels will be basically level.
The park came online in December. It produces enough energy to power around 55,000 homes annually. It's the first large-scale solar site in southeast Wisconsin, and environmental advocates say projects like this are an essential part of meeting Wisconsin's renewable energy goals. As more solar developments come online in Wisconsin, though, some of those projects are facing community opposition. Concerns can range from fears of losing rural landscapes to a distrust of developers and state regulators. Ron Taub lives in the town of Rome in Adams County. He's worried about a solar project that's been proposed on more than 2,000 acres in the town. He says people move to the area for its rural landscapes. He feels like locals haven't had enough input on the project.
I had to buy a $200 permit to put up a 10 by 15 shed on my property. Then you can put up 2,000 acres of solar panels, and oh, we have no control, it's private property.
Large utility-scale electric facilities, whether renewables or fossil fuel plants, must be approved by state regulators. They don't need local approval. State regulators have approved 30 solar projects over the last decade. State Representative Travis Tranel is a Republican from southwest Wisconsin. He's one of the authors on a bill that would require local governments to approve solar or wind projects that are more than 15 megawatts before they can be approved by state regulators. He said the State Public Service Commission's approval process feels like just a box that needs to be checked.
I am certainly not anti-renewable energy, but what we are doing is going to have a lasting and dramatic impact on what rural Wisconsin looks like.
In a statement, the Public Service Commission said regulators are required by law to apply the same level of scrutiny to renewables as they would for a new fossil fuel plant. The agency says it has an extensive, months-long process for approving projects. The state regulator estimates that approved solar projects account for less than 1% of agricultural land in the state.
The norm is that farmers decide what they do on their property. We don't typically ask community leaders to vote on what farmers are doing in other contexts.
That's Chelsea Chandler. She runs an organic fruit and vegetable farm in Lafayette County and also works for the nonprofit Clean Wisconsin. She says the bill requiring local approval would slow the clean energy transition.
This is sort of a novel idea that's being proposed for solar and wind specifically.
One farmer who chose to use his land for a solar development is Ed Howell of Union Grove. He's leasing more than 100 acres to the Paris Solar Park. He was approached by a developer a few years ago about leasing his land for the solar project.
We ran him off a few times and he kept coming back, and then we kind of researched some stuff.
After speaking with developers on and off for more than a year, Howell finally signed a contract to lease his property.
Everybody's story is different, but a lot of guys were our age or older looking for retirement, you know, and nobody ever got rich farming around here, so instead of selling it and moving to town, you could still retain ownership and still stay here.
Howell admits it was sad seeing the panels go in on land he's worked for decades, but overall he's satisfied with the arrangement, saying it will help him pass the farm along to the next generation someday. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, we recently received a question from a listener, Tyler in Milwaukee, asking,
what is the reason that it looks like all the buildings in Madison are all smaller than the state capitol building?
Thank you for the question, Tyler, and we've lined up two perspectives on this to dig into the answer.
The first stop is the director of Madison's Planning Division. Megan Tuttle helps community members, city officials, and others guide future development and growth in Madison. Megan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So what is your response to this listener question? Is it true that all of Madison's buildings are shorter than the state capitol, or is there different versions of that?
Yeah, this is a great question, and certainly something that anyone moving around Madison these days can probably see pretty clearly with the amount of construction activity that's happening. There is, in fact, a law in the city of Madison related to where and how buildings in the downtown can be developed to help protect important views of the Capitol itself. We have a series of laws that regulate development. This is called zoning. And one of those zoning laws is called the Capitol View Preservation Limit, which says that buildings that are within a mile of the center of the Capitol building cannot exceed the height of the base of those columns. So essentially making sure that dome really remains that prominent feature within our downtown landscape.
And layered on top of that is state statute, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and I'm going to read from state statute. No portion of any building or structure located within 1 mile of the center of the state capitol building may exceed the elevation of 1,032.8 feet above sea level. That is very specific, Megan.
Very specific, yep. And ultimately what it's about is the recognition that the Capitol sits on the highest point on the isthmus downtown. Our city planning has long recognized that that's an important aspect of how downtown was developed, going back to some of the original plans for the city. And we want to make sure that civic building continues to be a distinctive part of the downtown landscape. So really thinking about how it remains a prominent part of what we see both when we're close to it and when we're far from it, such as across the lake at Olin Park or down along East Washington. We have some minor exceptions, mostly for things like the spires of church towers or communications towers, mechanical penthouses, things like that. But really the vast bulk of the building should be lower than that height limit to ensure that view is preserved. We use things like height limits in our planning efforts to make sure that we're thinking about not only those types of views, but things like transitions between buildings, their location within the downtown, how we make sure that the scale and use of the building will help support some of our redevelopment priorities. But in this case, we're really just looking at sort of an absolute limit to that height.
You mentioned redevelopment priorities. Madison, like many Wisconsin communities, feeling a housing crunch. Is that statute, those restrictions, impacting the housing going up and the apartment construction? Does that push it out to other parts of Madison, or what is the impact?
Ultimately, this view limit, as you mentioned, both in the state statute and in the city zoning laws, applies to the buildings that are the closest to the Capitol. We have more permissive rules for how buildings come together in other parts of the city. We really lean on things like our planning processes to help us determine where housing can go and at what scale, and to make recommendations for how that housing may occur. We certainly see other opportunities to think about this height limit. Like in the past several years, we have thought about ways to allow taller buildings within the downtown that include a portion of housing that is permanently affordable. So we're constantly thinking about how these regulations and our city plans help us meet the need that we're experiencing, which is a great need throughout the city on the whole.
Right, because, you know, you're talking about real estate that you might say is the hottest in the city because it is of its proximity to downtown and to the state capitol. What impact does that have for developers or how we come to view what is permissible in this part of Madison?
We're looking at a couple of areas of the city where we've really been trying to prioritize where growth happens and aligning those zoning laws and other city investments to make sure that we're able to realize both the kind of value of the property where development may occur and to help get it into the locations where it aligns best with things like our transportation system and other infrastructure. You know, limits like this can sometimes be a push and pull on how we realize where those development priorities and development opportunities really are. In a lot of cases, these height limits are pretty permissive, even though we're trying to really protect that height of the Capitol from a view perspective. But we do know that we have other areas in the city where those heights are not as restricted. And so just trying to balance all of those factors kind of across the city and across the areas where we're trying to support growth to happen.
I would imagine Madison isn't alone here. And you spent years in Burlington, Vermont before this position. Did you encounter these issues before at all? I mean, you know, Burlington's not Montpelier, but have you seen this before?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the question of height limits is an important one when we're talking about planning. It's about how future development happens. It's about how the size and scale of new buildings fit in with the existing context. So this is certainly not a unique question for Madison. The view height limit was not as directly applicable in my work in Burlington, but certainly height limits in general were a major question. How tall should buildings be in downtown was something that was grappled with in a similar way to Madison, you know, really starting with a planning process that set the framework and the vision for how big new buildings should be within the downtown, and then putting that into our zoning laws. And there, ultimately, some important view sheds along major streets down to the lake and to the mountains across the lake were definitely things that we looked at very closely, too.
Megan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
That is Megan Tuttle, director of the City of Madison's Planning Division. She helped us answer a listener-submitted question about why buildings within a mile of the state capitol building cannot exceed its height. And thanks to Tyler in Milwaukee for sending that in. Now that we know about the restrictions incorporated in both state law and local Madison ordinance, we're going to find out about architectural aesthetics and the state capitol. Anna Andrzejewski is a professor of American art and architecture at UW-Madison. Anna, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why did lawmakers decades ago think it was important to preserve the view of the Capitol Dome?
Well, it actually has to do with zoning, as I think you've heard earlier. It goes back in Madison to 1966, when, as the story goes, there was a building on campus, Van Hise, that was 14 stories tall and really stood out on campus. And therefore, people in Madison were outraged, or some people were. And then this led basically to the height restriction that no building within a mile could be taller than the Capitol.
How does a state statute and local ordinances like this affect a city's culture and the way people interact, the way people live in a community?
It really does affect things. I mean, our environment does shape us. So when there are restrictions that stipulate, and this is true in almost any neighborhood, that a building can only be a certain number of stories high, it does sort of condition the way that people live. I think probably the best example of this is if you're in a very large city, say a place like New York or Chicago, and you have those really tall buildings. Sometimes you cross the street to go to the other side where the sun is shining. And, you know, it affects the way that you move through the city if it's a cold day and you need to be warm. But it's true in really any neighborhood. It affects, you know, how people come together, how they live, how they interact. And that's really true in any environment.
I would imagine it is a tricky balance in architecture. How do you create that density to make a project, you know, pencil out for developers and for sustainability without, as you mentioned, like casting a shadow over streets or restricting views and open space? Do those tend to be competing goals?
I think that they do historically. And I mean, we can go back to, you know, the early 20th century and in a place like New York City, as I mentioned earlier, there was this real desire once we had the technology, and that was steel frame construction and the elevator. Once we had that technology to build higher and higher, you know, that motivated people, especially when rents were rising in dense urban areas. But at the same time, that pressure to go up and make money and build ever higher really was competing with the fact that people were in these cities and wanted to move through them. In the first decade of the 20th century in New York, it got very, very dark along the city streets because of these tall buildings. And in the 19-teens, New York began stipulating setbacks at the tops of buildings to allow light to actually penetrate into the streets. So yeah, there's always been, I mean, going back, you know, more than 100 years and probably earlier, that tension between wanting density and density really being efficient and also wanting to preserve, you know, things like light and air, and having more space, more open space.
And you mentioned steel framing because more stories requires structural changes like, you know, concrete and steel framing. So perhaps the scale of a building project becomes even more costly as you go taller. And there would be potential trade-offs with taller buildings that might not seem so obvious right now in Madison because, you know, this is just how we've lived with these building heights.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's, you know, it is really a balancing act in multiple ways. You know, sometimes you build higher and higher and, you know, you don't anticipate things. I think this is, in fact, what happened in places like New York and Chicago before the setback laws went into place. You know, it just seemed logical to build higher and higher, greater stories. But when you do that, you have more bodies moving through the city. So you need more transportation. The light and air problem I mentioned, and one need only think of Chicago and the wind tunnels, you know, that were created through these tall buildings. So, you know, it's one of these interesting things about architecture and planning is that you can plan all you want, and sometimes the consequences are not always foreseen.
But on the flip side, when you're not hemmed in by height restrictions, I wonder, from an architect, does it free up some pent-up creativity that you would not be allowed to have with those height restrictions?
Sure. So I'm reminded of our own Frank Lloyd Wright and his desire to build a mile-high skyscraper at one point, which, of course, would exceed any height restriction anywhere, right? That was never built. So sure, at one level, it constrains. But, you know, I think urban areas, and one of the interesting things about them is that they are community spaces. I mean, even though their, you know, property is privately owned or managed, they are spaces that are used by the public. So the street is a public space. And I think if we remember that and think about that, these decisions really are negotiated between the architect or planner and the community. So it, you know, even though it might constrain one's creativity, the way that I'd like to think about it is that many of these decisions, and this is really the essence of zoning, it really is a product of our democracy because people have a say in what their cities look like.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That is Anna Andrzejewski, a professor of American art and architecture at UW-Madison, explaining how city ordinances may affect the culture of a city and how that can impact its growth and development. Earlier, we spoke with Megan Tuttle, the director of the planning division for the city of Madison. She talked about the rules that determine how tall Madison's buildings can be in relation to the state capitol building. This conversation came from an audience question from Tyler in Milwaukee as part of the Wisconsin Project. You can submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin, and that's WHYSconsin.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, the Milwaukee Brewers' famous racing sausages are a fan favorite. But how are they made?
Creating the sombrero for the chorizo, what the hot dog looks like, what the little racing characters look like. There's a lot of back and forth, and then comes production, where the creative artists bring these characters to life.
Ah, yes, the art of racing weenies. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Lee Rayburn.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The start of another Major League Baseball season is just around the corner.
And the Milwaukee Brewers host their home opener against the Kansas City Royals, returning to American Family Field at the end of the month.
And what Brewers game would be complete without the famous racing sausages?
For over 30 years now, the team's iconic edible mascots, bratwurst, Polish sausage, Italian sausage, hot dog, and chorizo, race through American Family Field ahead of the seventh inning.
A little bit of a head start, but check them out, Ron. They're swapping paint. The brat's in there, and they nudge him off the line. The chorizo he just gave up. He just ran out of gas.
Yeah.
Thank you for the sausage, play-by-play MLB. And behind these mascots is a historic mascot manufacturing company based in Milwaukee. Brian Adam is president and owner of Olympus Group. Brian, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, let's start with racing sausages lore. How involved has your company been in the design, in the manufacturing, in the evolution of these mascots?
The Milwaukee Brewers started the racing sausages as a icon on the scoreboard, where they race on the scoreboards. And then in the 90s, someone had the idea of creating racing characters. And Olympus has been involved since the very early stages in bringing these characters to life.
What is that journey like? The creative process, the manufacturing of them? So much has to come together.
So we have some extremely talented creative individuals here on our mascot team. They worked hand in hand with the Brewers in helping create the look of the different characters, creating the sombrero for the chorizo, what the hot dog looks like, what the little racing characters look like. There's a lot of back and forth, and then comes production, where the creative artists use their hands, their tools, their airbrushes, their spray guns, all the tools required to produce a mascot and bring these characters to life.
And you say you make most racing mascots with foam over other materials. Why foam?
Dense foam provides the ability to create certain shapes, but it also allows a performer to move and interact due to the weight. It's not too heavy.
That's what I'm wondering, is because how do you make mascots breathe? They can be really heavy. How do you make them be flexible enough for that mascot to do flips and tricks and interact and be on the move?
So it depends on the type of character you're creating. A lot of the mascots that are going to do flips and tricks are going to be designed to have the ability to do some acrobatic performances. So smaller heads, hands that are made out of maybe batting gloves, tennis shoes. And then there's other characters that are designed for more of a look. A giant Grimace costume isn't going to do flips. The Brewers racing sausages inside of a large baseball stadium need to be viewed from the upper deck. So they're quite large. They're quite top heavy. And there is zero chance that a performer is going to be able to do a flip inside of the chorizo mascot costume.
Do you take feedback and ever go back to the drawing boards to tweak these mascots or make them better in some ways?
Absolutely. So I used to be, back in my college days, Bucky Badger at the University of Wisconsin, and I performed as their mascot. And we would meet, and I would still meet, with the Bucky Badger mascot performers. And we would take their consideration and their feedback to making changes to allow the performers the ability to have a little more dexterity, or just take whatever suggestive feedback they've had to make the costume more user-friendly for the performer. We would take that feedback and then slightly redesign and tweak the costume. The challenge with an iconic character like Bucky or the Milwaukee Brewers racing sausages is you don't want to change the look. You still want them to look fairly consistent. And Bucky's got to look like Bucky, and the Bratwurst has to look like the Bratwurst.
So you went from Bucky to one day being president of a company that makes these mascots. Did you ever imagine that?
It's been an interesting journey. I did not envision that I would be doing this, that we would be manufacturing mascots early in my life, no.
Wow. So, you know, you not only do Milwaukee racing sausages, you make racing mascots for teams all over the place. Can you talk about what other ones stand out to you?
Yeah, so I'm a Milwaukee native. I'm born and raised here. I'm a diehard Brewers fan, so I have a strong bias for the Milwaukee Brewers racing sausages.
Thank you for that disclosure.
They're the best and most iconic
there
racing characters.
Yep.
I believe they were the first in Major League Baseball to have racing characters, and now have been emulated because of their success by all sorts of teams. So I know Pittsburgh has the racing pierogies. Cleveland has some racing hot dogs, including a Ricky Vaughn hot dog. So after the movie Major League, the White Sox has some racing alumni characters and announcers. The Royals have racing hot dogs. DC, the Nationals, has racing presidents. And then there are a whole slew of interesting minor league racing characters that we have produced over the years.
What do you think makes racing mascots so entertaining to the fans?
It's a good question. They're giant, silly characters. You don't really know what's going to happen. A giant mascot costume by its nature is not designed to be raced. So they'll topple over, they'll trip, and it's just kind of a fun, engaging part of the baseball experience.
Okay, I'm going to take you on a hypothetical for a moment. So if we were wanting a mascot for WPR, what would the process look like from the ground up? What journey would you take us on to create a unique mascot?
The magical mascot journey would start with an ideation. You know, we would talk back and forth about how best to represent WPR, what a character might look like, what type of character you might want. Then there'd be a dialogue around what type of performances the character would be doing. Is this going to be a kind of a meet and greet character? Is this a character that's going to be participating, you know, who needs to be able to do some of those acrobatics and those flips? And then we have some talented artists here that would work in some computer programs to create an initial sketch. We would go back and forth creating a sketch and an idea of what the character might look like with you. Once we have nailed down that we said, yep, WPR needs this crazy looking dragon. And then our team, once it's approved by you, would start the production process of creating a unique one-off WPR fire-breathing dragon.
With a microphone.
With a microphone, absolutely. And we'd bring the character to life.
Okay, asking for a friend here. How does going to the bathroom work while in costume as a mascot?
It doesn't. Typically, mascot performers won't be in a costume for more than, say, an hour. They'll take breaks. The costumes get very, very hot. It's tiring. When I was Bucky, we would run the big cheerleader flag out to start the game. Out of the tunnel, you'd come out, you'd grab this flag and run it to midfield and run it back. By the time you just ran to the 50-yard line, waved it a couple times, and ran it back to the end zone, you were exhausted and dripping sweat. So mascots do take frequent breaks. And when they're taking those breaks, that would be the opportune time to use the restroom.
A bit of a tour here of your manufacturing facility. How long might a single mascot take to produce, and how many hands are involved in its creation?
So there are different artists with different talents on our mascot team. So in a typical, say, a racing sausage, I bet you we're doing the bratwurst for the Milwaukee Brewers. I think it would touch five different mascot team members. You know, someone would help create the foam shape. Someone would help with the sketch. Another individual would be a talented seamstress that could sew it together. Another team member might be really good at patterning to create the dimensions, to create this shape. The entire process would take a couple of weeks. Best guess, it would be about 40 hours of production time to produce a mascot. And the unique thing about mascots is they're handmade. So there's no machinery or tools that we can press a button and automatically have a Yogi Bear tie made or have Bucky Badger's striped shirt made. It is literally team members using their hands, their tools, hot glue guns, scissors, and creating these things from scratch.
Wow. Wow. Your company has such a long history in Milwaukee, over 130 years. What keeps you there?
This is where our team is. This is where our talent is. We love this city. And we have some great people that work for us. That have over the years. We have a lot of team members. I can think of two team members who work in who help on mascots on our sewing team that started here in 1988 and 1989 and have been making all sorts of printed graphics and mascots for, you know, 30 plus years. And it's people like Raji and like Penny who are on our team that that keep us here.
Brian, thank you for the tour. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, Kate. My pleasure.
Brian Adam is president and owner of Olympus Group. It's a mascot manufacturing company based in Milwaukee. As we talk about the Brewers' famous racing sausages and their place in Milwaukee culture, we turn to a former Milwaukeean who's petitioning Lego to produce a new box set of the racing sausages. Todd Elliott is here, a former Milwaukee resident and an adult fan of all things Lego. Todd, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Set us up. What is this Lego set like that's depicting the Brew Crew's famous racing sausages?
Yeah, so I designed it late last year looking for a project to do. And we had the stuffed sausages. I bought them for my kids when we went to a Brewers game back in the day. So I used them as the model. I built all five sausages, started with Polish sausage. Once I had him design, the rest kind of fell pretty quickly in line. So it's all five sausages. They're about 9 inches high. So they're pretty good size. And once I got done designing them, I submitted to the Lego Ideas website as a potential set to be built later.
How did you even learn how to design a Lego set?
So I liked Legos when I was a kid. And then when I had kids myself, we bought Legos for them. Lego back in the day had an application where you could virtually build anything out of the Legos. It had all the Lego pieces in there, and every color that Lego had ever built or made was in there. There's another application because they discontinued using it, but there's another application called Studio that's built by this website called Bricklink, which Lego actually wound up buying. So I've used Studio. It's basically a virtual computer-aided design application where you can build Lego models in.
Did you have to create the instruction manual as well?
Yeah, so Once you're done building the actual model, then you can go through and kind of order the pieces as they're being built and make the actual instructions. And then it'll actually print out the instructions for you. Mm-hmm. So it does the whole thing.
You know, I'm a huge fan of the minifigs. And I would imagine there wouldn't be any minifigs in this set. Is that right?
No, there's no minifigs in the set. Although I did come up with a second version. So Lego has this line of products called Brickheads.
Mm-hmm.
So I designed the Lego sausages as Brickheads, all five of them. They're about a third of the size as the ones I originally developed, but those are available too.
When did you know that you had something here, that you really wanted to submit the design to Lego Ideas?
I just loved them because I thought they were fun and they looked good from my perspective. So I immediately submitted them to Lego Ideas. And then what I did afterwards is my kids said, hey, you should post that to Reddit. And so on the Milwaukee subreddit and the Wisconsin subreddit and the Brewer subreddit, I posted and said, hey, guys, you know, this is available. Please support it if you like. And I got a lot of traction on there, a lot of votes. And at some point, a reporter from the Journal Sentinel reached out, and then Fox News reached out and CBS. And so it just kind of snowballed from there. I was really taken aback by all the love that people had for these. And it's just been a lot of fun.
Okay. And bringing us to date, you have roughly 3,500 signatures for the sausages set. What is the submission process like and the signature gathering?
Yeah. So when you first submit an idea to Lego Ideas, you have, I think, if I remember off the top of my head, 60 days to get 100 votes. And if you get 100 votes, then they give you another 365 days.
Mm-hmm.
I got that, or maybe it was 180 days. And then when you get to 1,000, you get another 180 days. And if you get to 5,000, you get another 180 days. So cumulative, you can have up to like 2 years to get 10,000 votes. So that's how many votes you need. If you get to 10,000 votes, that's when Lego will then review your idea and decide whether they want to make it into an actual product or not.
And at that point, we figure out whether Lego is a Brewers fan.
Exactly. Fingers crossed that they are.
Well, you've since moved away from Milwaukee and the Brewers, although I'm sure you have the Brewers in your heart. You know, opening day is around the corner. Do you have plans to see a game again at American Family Field?
Yeah, unfortunately, my wife and I will be traveling for opening day, but I have been talking to my son, and then the thought would be we come back to Milwaukee maybe this summer for a long weekend and catch a couple games. One, to see the Brewers again, but then also to maybe drum up some more support for the racing sausages on the Lego site.
Oh, and those racing sausages should just embrace you with open arms.
Yeah. And I would love to. I don't know how this can make this happen. I don't even know how you even put your name in the hat. But one of my life goals would be to actually run as one of the racing sausages.
Well, you've put it out there now. Anything is possible, Todd Elliott. Oh, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you as well. It's been great.
Todd Elliott created a prototype for the Brewers' famous racing sausages made out of Legos. And earlier, we spoke with Brian Adam, head of a mascot manufacturer that created the racing sausages. Coming up Friday on the show, we'll be talking with the Raptor Resource Project about a pair of eagles nesting in a white pine tree overlooking the Mississippi River in Trempealeau.
This eagle pair is known as Mr. and Mrs. T, and they've been area residents since 2017.
But we don't have to travel to Trempealeau to see them. The Raptor Resource Project has a live nature cam giving us an ability to check out their nest any time of the day.
Mr. and Mrs. T look beautiful, but I've been fully invested in the eagles overlooking Big Bear Lake in California, where Jackie and Shadow are caring for two new eaglets. And we want to know, is there a live nature cam you like to watch? What are some of the interesting things you've seen?
Oh, our colleague Rob Ferret is fully invested in streaming Big Bears. Not the lake, but the actual big ol' bears. Share about your favorite nature cam. Call or text 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Lee Rayburn.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.